First of all, I'd better make sure right from the outset I'm pronouncing your name correctly. It's Kozol.
Right. Let me see if it's like Kozol. Equal
Kozol.
Emphasis.
Kozol. Yeah. Equal emphasis.
Kozol.
What kind of name is that?
Probably originally it was like Kozlovsky or something. My grandparents were Russian immigrants, and like an awful lot of us. And we probably got shortened at Ellis Island.
Yeah.
Boston Harbor.
Were your parents? You say your grandparents?
Grandparents.
Mm-hmm. Is your family a family of big readers?
Yeah, they were. Even my grandparents, though very poor, had been steeped in a biblical tradition. They were very devout Jewish people. And my mother and father, though not so devout, were very much involved with literature, sure. Even though my mother was not a modern liberated woman, she's a traditional mother and housewife in the old, long ago days when I was growing up, she read a lot. She was a Latin scholar. When I was in secondary school, she tutored me through 6 years of Latin.
Of Latin.
Isn't that amazing?
So you have a literary heritage.
Well, in a sense, my dad's a doctor, a psychiatrist, so he's grown up involved with his whole youth involved studying the works of Freud and Bleuler and Carl Jung and all the great men and women of the psychoanalytic world. And he loved literature too. He was always quoting Kipling. His taste was a little old-fashioned for me, but as we talk, and I think it'll emerge that there really are two very strong strands in my life, which for the past 20 years have been almost completely separated. One is my involvement with literature, with the humanities, as a student at Harvard and later at Oxford. My obsession was Elizabethan poetry, modern fiction. I could stay up all night reading Yeats and Auden, and I studied with one of the most wonderful teachers and poets of our time, Archibald MacLeish.
Oh, yeah.
Like I was planning to be a normal person and be a doctor when I met MacLeish.
Or the psychiatrist.
Yeah, maybe a psychiatrist. I would have been more prosperous and maybe a little more normal. But that part has remained, that love has remained very strong in me. I've never lost a sense that of all the treasures, all the wealth, all the privileges I was afforded by accident of birth, the one that counts most is the ability to be alone with 600 pages of Tolstoy. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to sound pretentious, but to be honest, it's a lot more fun than watching TV. And it's usually more interesting than the kind of company you're likely to run into on a Tuesday evening. So that's one part. And the other part is, you know, in 63, 64, I returned from Oxford and a couple of years in Paris, where I'd spent 3 years trying to write the great American novel, and suddenly found myself drawn to school teaching. I saw a sign in Harvard Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Harvard, as we pronounce it, asking for volunteers to tutor kids one summer, mm-hmm. and was sponsored by a civil rights organization. I went over and did this, and suddenly I found myself not just so concerned with the misery that was prevalent in this very poor neighborhood, but also so excited by kids. I enjoyed being with them so much that I signed up as a sub, since I wasn't a certified teacher. I couldn't get a regular teaching job, and I became a permanent sub teaching fourth grade. And that was exactly 20 years ago this year. So for 20 years, I've had this, you know, this extraordinary sort of parallel existence. On the one hand, I've been spending my days teaching fourth graders, fifth graders, later 12th graders. Later I ran a school, a community school for adults and children in a poor neighborhood in Boston. I worked in literacy with farm workers and their children in the Southwest. And yet at the same time, repeatedly, I've been drawn back to the university. I went back and taught at Yale one semester. And another time went to a lovely small college in Connecticut called Trinity College, and at one point considered taking an English teaching position at Harvard. So there's been this curious tension between wanting to do well and write well my whole life. And really, it's in illiterate America for the first time that I've been able to pull these two things together, the sense of urgency based on injustice, and then the deeper question of what is the ultimate wealth that we would like to share with people who have been excluded. And for years in the civil rights movement, when I was a younger man, the only things I would speak about, naturally because of the urgency, were the dreadful housing in which poor kids lived, the lack of food, the fact they went to school hungry, the fact that their school systems were so desperately underfunded, and the fact that they were politically disenfranchised. And of course, I'm still concerned with the fact that illiterate people are disenfranchised in a sense, because they seldom vote, and if they do vote, they can hardly make an informed vote based on a sensitive retrieval of the past. I mean, everything that Jefferson dreamed of when he spoke of the informed consent of the governed goes by the board when we realize that a third of the adults in America can't read a newspaper, let alone the words of Thomas Jefferson or the Bill of Rights. So the political part is still in me, for sure. But on the other hand, this is the 5 years that I've spent writing Illiterate America have given me a wonderful opportunity to pull together my love for literature, for scripture, for the word, and my sense of fair play. Because now, in the whole second half of the book, I'm able to ask the question, after people learn to read enough to survive, what does it take to prevail? And I don't mean to be pretentious, but I'm thinking of the words of American novelist William Faulkner when he received the Nobel Prize in Stockholm. He said, I believe that man will not merely survive, he will prevail. And most of the government dialogue you hear about illiteracy in America inevitably has to do with dollars and has to do with fairly mechanical stuff, and we've got to deal with that because a lot of it is just dangerous to us. But I have treasured the opportunity for the first time in my life to start with the day-to-day issues of survival and then kind of create a vision of what a truly literate society could be, and not just how much cash we'd have in our gross national product, but how much beauty.
Well, it's obvious that...
So that was a rather long answer,
well,
wasn't it?
It was.
It's a simple question.
it was long, but very apt, and it's obvious that you feel very passionately about this problem, and you paint a horrifying picture in illiterate America. I think maybe the way to start to look at this problem is to outline the dimensions of it, which you do in part one. Give us an idea of just how illiterate America is.
Good. Let's just run down some of the rough figures. I'm looking at my book because I don't want to misquote myself. Over 60 million adult men and women in America cannot read a daily newspaper. I'll start this.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Good? Okay. Over 60 million adult men and women, which is over one-third of the adult population of America, over 60 million cannot read a daily newspaper, even an undistinguished newspaper. They cannot read the antidote warnings on a bottle of kitchen cleanser in case their baby swallows it by accident. They can't read the sedative warning on a non-prescription drug, the little print which tells you not to take it before you drive. You may fall asleep at the wheel. They can't read road maps. They can't read street signs. They can't read the instructions on a bottle of medicine for their child. They can't read the lease they signed in order to live in an apartment. They can't understand any of the stuff that comes in the mail. And perhaps they can, perhaps some of those people can understand the simplest stuff. But God knows it's hard enough for all of us to understand the phone bills we get these days, the complicated bank statements, credit card bills, things like that. Imagine what it's like for people who read either not at all or at something like fourth, fifth grade level in a society in which the most banal newspapers are written at 10th grade level, in which the fine newspapers of America are written at 12th grade level, in which housing leases are written at 14th grade level, and in which there is hardly any employment available in any industry, but especially in high-tech industry, for somebody who reads below the 10th grade.
Who are these people? Who are these 60 million people who can't read?
Okay, the demographics are interesting. There is there's obviously a huge differential depending on how rich people are, and therefore, depending on their racial background. And only for that reason, because race and poverty are so closely connected. 16% of whites, 44% of blacks, 56% of Hispanics are illiterate or semi-literate in the English language. From that, it's quite obvious that the figure for blacks is three times the figure for whites. I interject quickly, so this will not be misunderstood, that this has nothing to do with intelligence, nothing to do with IQ, nothing to do with commitment, nothing to do with motivation. It's a pure index of poverty. Okay, now having said that, it's very important to remind our listeners that even though the figures are so much higher for those from minority backgrounds, there aren't 60 million non-white people in America. The vast majority of illiterate America is white and native-born. In the state of Utah, for example, which is about 95% white and native-born, very few immigrants, very few black people there, there are 200,000 illiterate adults in a population of only about a million. That's an important example to give. New Hampshire, just north of where I live in Boston, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, which is, along with Utah, is probably one of the two whitest states in America between race and snow. New Hampshire has massive numbers of illiterate people, not urban ghetto dwellers, but poor rural people, or people in depressed mill towns.
And you're saying this is all due to poverty?
Well, there are middle class people who have slipped through the cracks and because of a mistake, because of an unusually bad school, or because of a certain neurological disorder or some type of reading disability that wasn't detected, something of that sort. But by and large, the people who can't read are not people who have any type of brain damage. They're not people who have any type of neurological disorder. It's almost always a consequence of two or three things. The fact of having attended underfunded, understaffed schools in neighborhoods in which the teachers have been demoralized, in cities, for example, and in some of the poorer states like Mississippi, in which teachers receive salaries which are barely 5 or 10% above the poverty level. One of the facts that we often forget in the United States, when we speak of free and equal public education, it's true it's free, but it sure ain't equal. In Massachusetts, the most expensive, the most prosperous suburbs spend four times as much per child as the poorest school districts in the state. And I don't like to be too harsh on the United States. There are an awful lot of things I'm very proud of. And I've written this book, I hope, very much in the Jeffersonian tradition of somebody who has faith in the decency of America, who believes that the democratic process offers maximum opportunities for people to develop to their fullest. But I also think that a wise patriot is not a blindly jingoistic person who goes around with his head in the clouds and says, we're number one. We're not. In fact, in terms of comparative figures, we're 49th in the world out of 158 member nations in the UN. We're not number one. We're not number two. We're 49. In terms of books produced per capita in the United States, that is in ratio to our population, we're 24th in the world. Most of Western and perhaps Eastern Europe, too, Japan, seem to be way, way ahead of us.
That's what happens when you develop, when you're the first to develop television.
That's right. But one other point. It clearly has to do with underfunded schools. Mind you, I'm not blaming teachers, because teachers are as much victims as the poor kids they're teaching when you think of the kind of salaries teachers get in this country. But there's one other factor, and this is a delicate point. The children of non-readers are high-risk candidates for future failure themselves. This has to be handled carefully, because it may sound to people as though I'm saying, well, if kids can't read, it's their mother's fault or their father's fault. Why don't the parents care? Why don't they read to their children? In fact, we hear people saying this all the time. There's been a lot of rhetoric from Washington recently. Parents should read to their kids every night. Do you recall a report that was published 2 years ago, almost exactly 2 years ago, called A Nation at Risk? It was a major release from the Department of Education, made national headlines on the cover of all the news magazines. The report basically said that we're in grave trouble because of declining reading and math skills in the United States and because of very high illiteracy. And I might say the Reagan administration has pegged the figure even higher than I do. They say 72 million adults, which is nearly half the adult population. Anyway, when that report, A Nation at Risk, came out, I looked at it with consuming interest. The report ended with an old-fashioned exhortation to parents. And basically, to paraphrase it, it was saying, parents, in the long run, it's your kid. If your child can't read or is having trouble, don't blame someone else. Read your child. Use these words, I think. Read your child tonight and every night. Be a constant model of devoted, literate adulthood. Study your children's schoolwork. 35% of the parents in America could not read the news reports, which described that release from Washington. So I think it's very important to realize that the illiterate parent cares desperately about her kid or his kid. It's not a case of not caring. And I can't tell you how many of these parents will say to me, I know they need it and I can't give it. They can't help. I think in my book, I quoted one woman who moved me enormously when she I guess she had two little boys, and she probably herself, if I remember it accurately, she probably had herself been a child of non-readers or semi-literate people, probably was failing in fourth grade but got promoted mindlessly on, probably in an underfunded school, which as today again was losing all its extra federal money for reading teachers, probably was a repeat ninth grader, probably dropped out in the 10th or 11th grade, probably was pregnant when she was 18, and now she has two little boys. And she says to me, I can't read to them. That's leaving them out of something they should have. My little boy, Donnie, wanted me to read a book to him. I told Donnie, I can't read. And then she looked at me and she said, oh, it matters. You believe it matters. Now, the reason I quote that partly is just because she's so eloquent. It gives us some hint of all the beauty we're losing. She might be a great poet if she could write. But I'm also just thinking that it's a marvelous evidence of the fact that these people care about their kids, but they cannot help them. And I say in illiterate America that if we don't address this problem, today is 60 million, we'll be 80 or 90 million by the end of the century.
What is the social toll? What is the social toll? Or is the United States big enough to
absorb
these people just swallowed up? I can't tell you if I know any illiterate people, because I don't normally associate with illiterate people.
Well, it's interesting.
They're obviously out there.
Until I got into this work, I would have assumed there were a few illiterate people in very poor neighborhoods, something like that. Illiterate people are likely to be working right next to you, perhaps not in this radio studio, but maybe in the next one, over.
No, I think you cite the example of the art director.
Sure.
New York Times.
I describe a man who goes to work every day. He buys the New York Times, tucks it under his arm along with his briefcase, puts it on his desk while he's doing his work during the day, brings it with him to lunch. It's his shield against humiliation. And he's learned how to bluff his way through so nobody will ever know that he can't read. And he's one of the fortunate illiterate people who's at least able to use his ingenuity to hold a job. But God, how that man must suffer.
Wouldn't it be easier for him to take a crash course?
Yes, that's a very good point. Illiterate people tend to devote far more energy to disguising their inability to read than it would ever take to overcome the problem. The trouble is that when they do get the guts up and the nerve to say, I need help, I don't want to keep being dependent on other people to tell me what's on the menu in a restaurant, to read street signs to me, or in the case of those who can't get work, to live on welfare, to live on somebody else's taxes. When they get the courage to say that, and hundreds of thousands do, they usually find that there is nobody available to teach them. They answer advertisements, usually TV plugs and radio plugs. They'll call up a number. They'll go to an office, and they'll be told, sweetly, well, we'll put you on the waiting list. In Illinois alone, 140,000 adult illiterates overcame their embarrassment, approached local literacy organizations and were either turned down or put on endless waiting lists. Why? Because they said they had lost the federal funds to organize the program. We're not even talking about federal funds to pay for, let's say, 10 million tutors to tutor 60 million people. We're not even talking about that. We're just talking about the money it would take to organize a couple hundred thousand programs in the country, which could then exploit all the volunteer strength which exists among the retired, the college kids, even literate high school kids, and people in the poor communities themselves. But you can't use volunteers without a good, smart, and properly paid person to man a telephone, to organize, to get materials, to train, to supervise. That's the tragedy. Right now, the federal government's spending $1.65 for each illiterate adult in America per year, $100 million for 60 million people, which is less than we spend on military marching bands. Now, this is penny-wise and pound-foolish. It's not good for Democrats, and it's not good for Republicans. It's not good for poor who suffer. It's not good for the rich who pay. The tragedy is that when people finally overcome their inhibitions and show up and ask for help, they're told, I'm sorry, we've already taken our 60 students. Maybe we could get to you next year.
Now, Jonathan, we're going to lose our studio space shortly, so we're going to move ahead a little bit. In part two of Illiterate America, you have outlined a plan that you call a plan to mobilize illiterate America. Part of the idea that you have, I don't know if it was all tongue-in-cheek because you're dealing with a publishing industry that is a profit-making enterprise, but you want to flood neighborhoods and churches and schools with books, all kinds of books. Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, I think it's not my idea. I've heard publishers discuss this, and I tend to take people at their word. So when generous, rich people tell me that in the publishing industry, tell me how many millions of books are shredded every year because they can't be sold and are just taking up warehouse space. The thought of books being shredded.
I thought they were remainder.
Well, they remainder the popular ones for 69 cents. The ones they can't remainder go into the shredder. And even very, very good books are shredded once they go into paperback. And then conversely, it works the other way around. After the $3 paperback has gone into an $8 paperback, and then the cheap paperback gets shredded. So there's an awful lot of books either rotting in warehouses or being turned back into pulp, I suppose, in this awful machine called the shredder, which seems an atrocity in an illiterate society.
Book burning, doesn't
it? Well, it sounds awful, despite the fact that the motives are purely economic. But several publishers have talked with me about this plan, which I've suggested, as an adjunct to the massive volunteer plan I've proposed, and as an adjunct to the multi-billion-dollar federal allocation it would take to get the ball rolling.
Well, we have to back up a little bit. What good would be flooding the country with
if people can't read them.
Books if you can't read?
Well, that's... Well, it's sort of the cart and the horse, but in this case it's hard to know which is the cart and which is the horse. Clearly, it's no... People who can't read aren't going to make much use of books, but as I say in the book, it seems to me that the proximity of good books... I mean, if you could imagine something like this, if you could imagine not just a couple of really fine, handsome, and expensive-looking bookstores on beautiful places like Fifth Avenue, New York City, which are intimidating to poor people, and I should think to illiterate people, and also expensive. Instead of that, if you could imagine hundreds of thousands of kind of neighborhood storefront libraries, but I call them one-way libraries. We did this in Boston some years ago, and actually we didn't intend to give the books away. But we just thought we'd start a kind of an informal library in a poor neighborhood where we could see a lot of people who are on the edge of writing, of reading, and we thought that they probably would have higher motivation if they saw that the books were available, if they saw the covers of the books, if the books intrigued them. So I wrote off to a couple publishers, and I found they were very generous. They said, what do you want? Here's a list of all the books we've got in our warehouse. And a lot of them were classics. I mean, some of them were marvelous books, like... Mark Twain's work, for example, whom, despite all the critics, I still consider an eminently suitable book for black and white alike in the USA. You know, and they had classics, they had Shakespeare, and they had contemporary high-interest books and so forth. They sent us something like 6,000 or 7,000 books. It was
almost
marvelous.
Like a surplus food center.
Oh, it was great. And what we did is we put them up in racks. Instead of putting them into tight bookshelves, we made like easels. Mm-hmm. You can picture that out of plywood. So you can see the front of the book. And it was extraordinary. And here was a neighborhood in which I would bet you about 40% of the people were either illiterate or barely literate. It was amazing how many of those books went home and then never came back. So within a couple of weeks, you know, we first were tearing out our hair, figuring, well, how can we get them back? Should we go into all the projects? And I wasn't an outsider. I lived in this community. I lived for 18 years in a very poor white, black, and Hispanic neighborhood in Boston. And some of the people working with me were parents from the neighborhood. So it's not like we were outsiders intruding, but we still felt sort of funny about going into people's homes and saying, hey, you know, give us back Tom Sawyer, you know, who's got Oliver Twist, you know. So it suddenly occurred to us that it would be much easier, instead of trying to retrieve the books, it would be much less work to write to two other publishers and get 5,000 more, which is what we kept doing. And in this way, the concept of the one-way library evolved. And what we soon found was that the people who took the books out weren't always the ones who read them. Sometimes a guy would take a book out because it intrigued him, but in fact he couldn't read it. But his older sister could, and she'd pick it up and she'd read it, and sometimes then she'd start to help him, and she'd tease him into reading it, by just tempt him by telling him what it was about, that sort of thing. A wife would bring a book home and her husband would end up reading it. The point is, most of those books were being read somewhere. I mean, despite all the cynicism some of us may have about people being hooked by the TV tube, it was interesting to find when we went into the homes, there's a lot of hunger for good spiritual nutriment in this society. And usually somebody was reading those books. Very few cases did we find the book was torn up or thrown in the trash.
The one-way library.
And I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, well, it's only one facet of this rather sweeping plan that you have. Can you very briefly outline some of the other aspects of it?
Okay, now this time, as Polonius said, in short, I will try to be brief. Okay. I see... an immediate allocation, something like $10 billion a year for about 10 years. That sounds like a lot of money, but let's remember right away that illiteracy is costing us $120 billion every year in lost productivity, in prison costs. Two-thirds of prisoners are illiterate, in welfare attributable to the unemployability of people who can't read to meet the modern job market. Okay, so I'm talking about $10 billion. Now, that $10 billion isn't going to pay for 10 million teachers, quite obviously. What it is going to pay for is tens of thousands of good, effective organizers, church basements, storefronts, neighborhood centers, in rural areas, perhaps an abandoned house, in urban areas, perhaps an empty apartment in a big housing project. It's going to pay for telephones in order to keep in touch with students and scheduling their appointments. It's going to pay for the people who match up tutors to students, sometimes one-to-one, sometimes in groups of five or six. Sometimes it's better to do it in a small group because illiterate people can reassure each other. So for that much money, what we could do is galvanize something above 5 million Americans. I'd like to see 10 million people involved in this. Perhaps half of them would be students, college kids, literate high school kids. Might give credit to kids, credit for spending a year of their life while they're being educated, teaching someone else who can't read at all.